You're listening to the Youth Crick Podcast on KHZ Network. Find us on Facebook at WUNG Radio and find us on Twitter at WUNG. If you like this episode, please leave a like and comment on our iTunes page at KHZ Network. And now for the podcast.
They were three cops who had nothing in common.
Freeze! Big B, what are you doing here?
Hey, you know me, I'm keeping the streets safe, boys.
One would do anything to get ahead.
You're truly prepared to be despised within the department?
Yes, sir, I am.
One had his own brand of justice.
How's it gonna look in your report?
It'll look like justice. That's what the man got.
And one loved the spotlight.
What exactly do you do on the show, Jack?
I teach Brett Chase how to walk and talk like a cop.
The Night Owl Massacre. This is a heinous crime that requires swift resolution. Six victims. One of them, one of our own. Interrogations will be led by Lieutenant Edmund Exley.
I need some backup. Come on.
All right, college boy, I'll help.
Now, all of them are faced with solving one case.
Don't move!
I want confessions, Edmund.
Oh, I'll break them, sir.
These people are all in the morgue.
And someone has to pay for it.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Youth Critic Retrospective. I'm your host, Kale Smith, and joining me today is Brandon Cooley.
Hey, everyone.
And today we are going to be talking about L.A. Confidential for its 20th anniversary. I don't remember exactly when this movie came out. However, it is 20 years old and it won the Oscar the following year for Best Picture and Director and Supporting Actress. Am I missing any?
Well, Titanic won Best Picture.
Oh, damn it.
It was... Well, Titanic sweep the Oscars. Kim Basinger won Best Supporting Actress, and I think it won Best Screenplay, Adapted Screenplay. So.
How did I forget that? That's like the most like memorable.
The Oscar biggest sweep ever. Yeah.
Well, in that case, no, they did not win all the Oscars, but they won. They won two Oscars. They won Kim Basinger and screenwriting for Adapted Screenplay, or what was then called, get this, screenplay based on material previously produced or published. interesting. So, and on top of that, I think we have to mention, since Kevin Spacey is in the movie, I think we have to kind of address the issue for those who have been living under a rock or just haven't been paying attention to the news. Kevin Spacey, back in late October, had been I'm blanking now on the word, but it was reported that from a story from actor Anthony Rapp that he had been sexually assaulted by Spacey at a very young age, and then after that story got out, it was Kevin Spacey released a statement hours later confirming that, not really confirming, but just, you know, in an apologetic manner, but also in the second paragraph of his statement saying, confirming he was gay, which, you know,
it's a bad time to come out.
Yeah. It's a horrible, horrible time to confirm you're gay. Yeah. And to be fair to Spacey, or, well, not really being fair, but to be, you know, it's been essentially, it's the worst kept secret that he is a gay actor. Essentially, like, it is the worst kept secret in Hollywood, but this was, you know, sort of a new awakening, a new thing to be brought up. And especially in the limelight of things. However, after that, it kind of, you know, created this, you know, snowball effect of more accusations coming out, and then ultimately House of Cards fired Kevin Spacey from House of Cards, and then I think there's a whole other movie that's completed, because I think on IMDb it said it was completed. There's a whole movie about Gore Vidal that's finished. And and but now from Netflix, I don't think that's going to be released for at least a while. And as of recently, he has a new movie coming out on December 25th called All the Money in the World. Ridley Scott movie with Mark Wahlberg and Michelle Williams. Well, 3 weeks ago, his role completely got reshot with Christopher Plummer in the role of J. Paul Getty. And now that movie is just barely coming in on time, just so they could, you know, do the Oscar race with All the Money in the World, and while also getting Kevin Spacey completely out of the movie. So
I think that's going a bit too far. I don't know. That's because they replaced
the actor out.
Yeah, replacing with Christopher Plummer. I think that's going a bit.
I think it would have ruined the movie. Any chance the movie
really?
That? Oh yeah, because I'm.
I'll still watch Kevin Spacey movies and not feel any differently about his performances. I mean, it sucks that he did what he did, but I just don't really feel like it matters. I mean, in terms of a movie.
Well, here's the problem. Well, I think it would have just publicly ruined the movie, because that's all people would see in the movie is Kevin Spacey, the molester or the pervert. That's all they would see. And it is, it's unfortunate, but that's how I think a lot of people would perceive it, and it would ruin any chance the movie had. And Ridley Scott really championed this movie. Like, he really, like, this was, you know, a situation like he had on The Martian, where he read that script and loved it and wanted to make it immediately. This was that same kind of deal where he wanted it done, where he wanted to get it through and get it, you know, done, and wanted it to be, you know, shown to the world. And yeah, it was just an unfortunate, it is a little concerning, because, you know, we're replacing actors in the blink of, you know, in weeks, but as far as I know, it was completely a Ridley Scott decision. Like, the studio did not, you know, they did not, you know, carry their weight. If anything, they were ready to push the movie back, but Ridley Scott was like, no, we'll make the movie on time, and we'll make and we'll just replace the actor. And that was the whole thing. And so it is a little disconcerting, but I understand the thing. And as far as the allegations, and of course, everything I'm mentioning, it's all allegations, because we can't legally say that this happened for real or not. And the reality is, we, you know, on the show, we are in full support of the victims, and all we can say is we're really sorry this happened. And yeah, it's probably for the best to get rid of Kevin Spacey. At least, you know, have some, you know, if anything, have, you know, a reason, have some justice in this world. And that's the reason, and that's why I'm okay with the whole All the Money, you know, him being replaced on All the Money in the World, and him getting cut from House of Cards, and his other the Gore movie is, you know, being like put on the back burner for now. So I'm okay with it personally. Brandon, do you have any more thoughts on this before we
I've never had any thoughts on this, really. Like I said, it's not gonna affect the way I see his performances. Although, like I mentioned, American Beauty is going to be very awkward to watch now.
Yeah.
But besides that, I don't really care, honestly. I know it sounds bad for me to say, but it's just, I mean, it's been happening so much in Hollywood now. There's so many cases of this. It's just another story.
It's dated.
It's none of our business, and he shouldn't be hired for any more movies, obviously. But I don't really care that much.
Okay. And yeah. So in relation to the show, because I went through this whole thing, we're not celebrating Kevin Spacey, the actor in this. We're not celebrating the actor because in my opinion on the show is, you know, a lot of fucking people made LA Confidential.
I'm still fine celebrating his performances in Usual Suspects and American Beauty. I mean, it's separate from the person. I mean, there's a lot of people in Hollywood that suck that still give good performances. I mean,
Right, but I mean, that's what my point is, you know, Kevin Spacey did not write, produce, direct, act, cater, photography. He did not do every single role, so it's not, I don't think it's fair to blame, you know, to cut, you know, and I don't think it's fair to, you know, not love a movie or praise a movie because of an actor or one part of it, because he is in the movie, but he's not the movie. If that makes any sense to
anyone. Well, sure. But even if this was like a movie starring him, I wouldn't really feel differently. I mean, we wouldn't like.
Sure, but
it's a performance. More. I mean,
sure. I'm still on my point. You know, even if it was him as a star, it still is, you know, it still is, you know, there are a lot more machinations and more movement going around, but on the flip side, I do see that people cannot separate the artist from the art. It's just for this particular case, Brandon and I, we're going to approach this as we're praising the movie more. We're celebrating the movie's anniversary more than the performance. So that I said all this to clarify, we're not, you know, this is not going to be a Kevin Spacey love fest.
Well, actually, he's not even really the main character in this. At the time he was kind of at the height of his like stardom. So, I mean, he was the first listed actor, but he's probably the third wheel third most important character in the movie. It kind of plays into the twist actually halfway through or two thirds of the way through, which we'll get to in a second. That'll be the spoilers portion of the podcast. But Dustin Hoffman, this was the case too, and I'll never look at Rain Man any differently. It's still a great movie. I get it. But I mean, we don't know these people though, so it's not like we're, you know, movies produced by Harvey Weinstein don't change. I mean, it's just the people suck.
I get that, but but the thing is, we still go and watch their work. We still praise their work. So. Yeah. You know, that's really that's the thing is, and it's difficult. It's so fucking painful. It's painful in my head because I'm like, I loved, I love A Ghost Story and Manchester by the Sea, but Casey Affleck is a fucking asshole.
Yeah. Well, that was actually allegations too, and it was never clear if he was
I think they settled in court.
Yeah, they did. I was never clear exactly how that went down. I did hear that, but I just think the performance is separate from the person personally. It would be different if we were actually paying these people like money to them to see their performance, but it's really we're paying to see the movie. It's not like we're actually like endorsing their behavior by seeing their movies. It's not the same thing.
I'll just say this. It's really you're making great points. It's just I'm trying to see it from I'm seeing it from the perspective of the victims, and it really sucks because their work is, I mean, it must suck to, you know, sit there and be like and hear all this praise for someone that abused you.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think don't think of, you know, this review as a, like I'm saying, hold on, Brandon.
Not
going
to think that.
Don't just, you know, we're celebrating the movie because it really is like a great movie. So with that's all said, Brandon, I will start with you. What do you think of LA Confidential?
Okay. in a nutshell, this is like in my top 30 favorite movies. I was the one who suggested this since it was the 20th anniversary. Yeah, there's a lot of good movies that came out in 1997. This one, I think, is probably the best, though. It's hard to put my finger on why, but I've always loved the atmosphere of this movie. It's a mystery, and it's kind of a noir, but it's not completely that kind of film noir feel. It's not black and white. It doesn't have the cinematography that most film noirs have. It's more of a period piece. It takes place in the 50s. I think it's probably, in terms of like period pieces, it's one of the most like accurate ones to capture like the culture at the time, and takes place in LA, obviously, and just that kind of like that atmosphere of 50s culture and the way police did their job back then, and kind of the
it's strangely relevant to now.
Well, actually, I was going to mention it's relevant today, but also very, very relevant at the time when it came out, because I didn't know this when I first saw it, because I wasn't familiar with the history of like the culture in the 90s. But it was only like 3 years after, or let's see, it was 5 years after the Rodney King riots and that whole case of police brutality. And actually, if you watch this movie, I don't care as much about the mystery. I care more about the characters, and it is about police brutality in many ways. That's kind of the theme of the movie, and how far police are willing to go to expose, to catch the criminal, and also to expose corruption. It's kind of like a do the ends justify the means kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I like about the movie, not so much about the mystery. It's kind of, to me, the mystery of who committed the crime is kind of secondary to that, which is nice.
Yeah, that's what all right, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm done. That was
okay. Yeah, that's a big thing I love about this film too, is that it's basically, we start with Guy Pearce's character Exley, and he is essentially trying to basically prove to everyone around him as a detective, you do not have to be abusive. You do not have to, you know, the ways of getting results from criminals doesn't work, and it's completely unnecessary. And he's trying to prove, however, as he grows as a character, he realizes that that he has to ultimately bend the rules of the law in order to fight corruption, especially in the sense of, you know, especially in the time, you know, he's going through, in that LA is going through kind of a power vacuum. Everyone's trying to fight for power now that Mickey Cohen is out of the picture. So you have the police that are trying to get into control of the whole drug trade. And then you have the fallout of Mickey Cohen's group trying to get back in, you know, trying to, you know, it's just like, it's interesting how everything kind of ties into this idea of, well, there's a power vacuum and there has to be someone to fill it. And it might as well be someone who is either as ruthless as Mickey Cohen or more ruthless. And that's what I really liked of this idea of the movie. And then it goes more into the LA noir, and then it becomes even more complicated when Kim Basinger gets in the movie, and then it just gets more and more crazy and all, you know, it's all really interesting how everything kind of fell into place in this movie. Especially in the third act with Russell Crowe's hothead character, which that's perfect casting, by the way.
Well, it was before Guy Pearce and Russell Crowe were really famous. That was kind of their start. And I guess they kind of predicted Russell Crowe's kind of personality. Well, the thing is with the characters, is that it's funny. The three of them by themselves don't really interest me all that much, because they are kind of like archetypes. Like the good cop, bad cop thing isn't really anything new. Guy Pearce is that character, Ed Exley. And let's see, Buddy, is that his name?
Yeah, Buddy White.
Buddy White, yeah. The good cop, bad cop thing isn't anything new. It's just more about the conflict between them. Like my favorite sequence is when they're going to the house that has Russell Crowe kills the man responsible for capturing this woman and kind of frames it. He frames it to make it look like he shot first at him, the criminal shot first. And he basically plants evidence that way. Kind of that thing where do the ends justify the means. And of course his audience members were like, yeah, do that because this guy sucks and you don't want to see him get away, you know. But at the same time, he's breaking the law, you know. And it's that scene right after when, you know, Guy Pearce confronts him about it and he just almost punches him. That's the kind of why it's so fascinating. I mean, because at the end of the day, I mean, Russell Crowe is kind of just this brute. He doesn't change by the end. And I guess Guy Pearce's character kind of does in some ways, but it's just interesting to see the conflict between them. I felt
right.
We won't get into the end before not the spoiler.
And I completely agree. It's very, I mean, the character Bud White doesn't change that much, but he learns to be, I don't want to say less of a brute. He learns to be smarter by the end. Like, he learns that, you know, oh my God, I'm being manipulated because I'm so caught up in my own insecurities and my own trauma and what I instinctively know as right or wrong and how I handle it. Like, he is being manipulated, you know, throughout the film, and it's revealed. And that's one of the great things about the movie is how, I'll just spoil it. It's James Cromwell's character, Dudley Smith. He is the bad guy. And it's interesting how he is manipulated everything going to try and get himself out. Like, that's a real, like, you know, if that, the whole movie was about him trying to get out of whatever crime, you know, syndicate he was a part of, that would be alone. That alone is more interesting, because just seeing how he has manipulated everything is so incredible. It is like incredibly smart in how he uses Bud, because he knows he's a hothead and he will beat the fuck out of anyone. So he knows how to put all the pieces together and knows what the weaknesses of Exley is, and knows, you know, not as much about what's Kevin Spacey's character again?
I don't even think of Kevin Spacey when I think of Hella Confidential, honestly. It's just funny that he was first listed, because, I mean, Jack Vincent. The twist is that he gets killed.
Yeah.
Like, 2/3 into the movie. I guess that was more of a surprise for people at the time seeing it than, I didn't know going into it, but he's really a supporting character. He's not really, like, just interesting. Yeah, that they,
Well, it's a surprise, because Kevin Spacey plays the smartest character in this movie. I mean, yes, you can debate Exley is smart in execution on how he goes about things, and if it wasn't for Bud, a lot of things would, you know, turn out differently. However, I will make an argument that Kevin Spacey's character, Jack, is the most smart, because he's the most outside of it all. Like, he's fascinated in the Hollywood aspect of police work. He's more fascinated in being, you know, the hotshot star. So for him to, you know, get in the grit with Exley, it's much more fascinating for him, and it's easier for him to solve the case than it is for Exley. And it's even in how he even, like, throws the one line to the Dudley, Rollo Tomasi. That's incredibly smart. It's a brave chance, but it's incredible. I argue that Jack Vincent is the smartest character in this movie.
I never thought about it, really. I would probably say Guy Pearce's character is the smartest. It depends on the way you look at it. I mean, I know you hate it when I say this, but this is a movie where, like, the story isn't really why I love it so much. It's more of the moving parts and how it all comes together. Sure. I mean, it's a great screenplay, because it's great dialogue, partly because it's delivered so well by the actors. It's like one of the best, like, ensemble casts in a movie. It just all comes together. I mean, like it's funny, in 1997, this isn't even the best story that year. Like, I think Good Will Hunting and Boogie Nights have much more interesting protagonists than this.
Yeah, sure.
I just love this movie more because it just captures the feel of, like, you feel like you're with them. You're with the detectives in the 1950s, you know, investigating this. And it's just that it puts you there in the setting, and it's just effective in the way it does that, I think. Like, the Rollo Tomasi thing, I mean, it's fine, I think. The mystery, I'm not really a fan of, like, of mystery movies per se. Like, I like, there's some that I like, but the ones I do like, though, are always for different reasons than the actual mystery. Like, Chinatown, I like the themes and the main character, not really the mystery that's involved in the whole conspiracy in that movie. Trying to think of other ones. Usual Suspects, same reason. But yeah,
I'm trying to think too. I can't think of any off the top of my head. Michael Mann's The Insider be considered one? Or Heat?
It's been a long time since I saw that. The Insider. That's the
It's
the whistleblower. where Russell Crowe's plays the lawyer who represents the smoking cigarette company. Yeah. I'm not sure that's a mystery. That's like a drama, I think.
Okay.
I'm thinking like murder mysteries, you know? Like,
I can't think of any on the top of my head.
Yeah.
I want to get into Danny DeVito. Cause I think for me, like, he doesn't have a lot to do in this movie, but his character and his purpose is fun for me. Like, it is a fun character.
Oh, he's comic relief, you know.
And it's perfect. Yeah, he's a comic relief that joins the wrong side. He was on the wrong side of history.
Well, it's fascinating. He's almost kind of like, he's not the narrator, but it begins with him narrating it, which I think is a great opening. Mm-hmm. That opening sequence of the credits playing while he's narrating the Hush Hush magazine puts you in that, you know, it gives you a good idea of what's going to come, you know, the kind of movie you're going to watch. It's a serious movie, but it's not too serious, you know, that kind of feeling. Like, it knows what it's doing in terms of, it knows it's, what's the right way to
it's
put
not,
it?
Yeah, it's not oppressively dark.
Yeah, that kind of thing, which is nothing against those kind of movies, but this isn't the kind of movie that's going to take itself too seriously, you know.
It's just a fun detective story. And I think that's the thing. And I think that's the thing that people kind of have issues with other films, is that these movies, they're just meant to be fun. Like, these, like Curtis Hanson and Brian Hegland, they just wrote a fun, smart noir movie. They wrote and where that's filled with twists and characters are used very well. I am a little surprised that Kim Basinger won the Oscar, because I think as a performance, like, she's fine, mm-hmm. but it's nothing. Like,
I think she's good in it, but if we're talking about 1997, she definitely shouldn't have won, because that definitely goes to either Julianne Moore in Boogie Nights or Minnie Driver.
Oh, yeah.
Those, the two of them were much better, I think, in terms of their performances, but I like her in this though. I mean, she's still good.
Yeah, I mean, she's good. It's just, I still think this and Vicky Vale are from Batman are like the better character, or like equally good, if that makes any sense.
I wouldn't say equally good. Vicky Vale from Batman's kind of a two-dimensional character, really. There wasn't much going on there. I mean, she's fine, but she did the best she could with that role. But
right. But yeah, I'm actually looking at the list of supporting actress, and I'm like, I would go with Julianne Moore, because Julianne Moore just has a lot more complicated things happening with her character. So, I mean, and yeah, Kim Basinger, like, she has to, you know, her character has to play a role as she has to survive in a world where, you know, where she has to survive in a world where all these men are using her to manipulate other men.
Yeah.
And
I'm not going to like argue against her winning though, because she's still good. And we have to keep in mind that a year after that, Gwyneth Paltrow won for Shakespeare in Love and the movie won Best Picture. So, you know, there's much worse out there in terms of what won and what, you know,
that's a state
Oscar winners, but that's have you seen that?
Actually, I have the movie. Weirdly enough, I found the movie. God.
It's so bad. I was watching Disaster Artist, and that movie is shown playing in the theater when they drive by. I'm like, oh my God, don't show that and playing in the theater. That's like,
yeah.
I was given painful memories of watching that movie. I hate Shakespeare in Love.
It's personally weird, because I have the movie, but I've never seen the movie. Like, I found the movie in like one of our like moving boxes. And I was like, oh shit, we have this movie.
Yeah. Well, what's even more interesting too is that I watched the movie Elizabeth recently, which also came out that year. And it takes place in the same, it's an excellent movie. Have you seen it yet? Or
I've seen bits and pieces of it.
It's outstanding. And it takes place, it's the same kind of period piece that, and it even has the same character. I mean, Judi Dench won for playing Queen Elizabeth, and Cate Blanchett plays Queen Elizabeth. And it's just, I can't believe that they, for one, Saving Private Ryan didn't win, but also the Elizabeth plainly the better period piece didn't win that year. I mean, because Shakespeare in Love is all fictional. It's all fake. None of it's true.
I think it's we're gonna have a joke.
I mean,
I think next year we're going to have to do a stay tuned.
Yeah, we should. Yeah.
Or do like Shakespeare in Love versus Elizabeth.
Yeah. And maybe it's not as bad as I remember it because I haven't seen it in a few years, but I just remember really not liking it. It's not only because it won, but just as a bad movie. I mean, but yeah.
Yeah, that was the Weinsteins at the height of their power.
Yeah, I guess.
Damn. yeah.
Yeah, we'll review that one. Yeah.
We will. We should definitely do that next year. I don't know when exactly those movies came out, but we'll definitely do those at some point next year.
Because usually we're praising movies when we do like the anniversaries, which makes sense, but it may be kind of fun to look at a movie that's not so good.
Yeah. Well, it's just no one really remember, I guess, unless it's like painfully bad, like a Batman and Robin or fucking Battlefield Earth or something.
Yeah.
No one really wants to talk about movies that were just mediocre and okay.
Oh yeah, because it's certainly not as bad as Batman and Robin. But at the same time, Batman and Robin's funny bad. It's almost so bad that it's enjoyable to watch.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's so a cartoon.
Shakespeare in Love is boring. It's just not, it is miserable to watch because it's just not, it's so mediocre. And, you know, it's, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we probably should do that because, yeah, I don't think we've ever done a bad movie on, well, I mean, not counting the Friday the 13th and the fucking Halloween worse, not counting Halloween fucking 5. But yeah,
that's funny bad though, you know, it's expected.
Oh, well, those are not funny bad. Those are just bad.
Okay, well, yeah.
Yeah, we haven't done a bad movie. We should definitely do that.
Or maybe pick a movie where like I hate it and you think it's good, or like, or I think it's good and you hate it. Like, I know there's a few like that. King's Speech is one of them. I enjoy it.
We should definitely do Lincoln one day.
But you didn't hate that. But yeah, but you didn't hate that, did you?
Let's just say I was eagerly anticipated, and I think I fell asleep twice while watching it.
Really?
And I think I think the only other person that saw it in the same theater with me walked out just because she could not get any more refills on Dr. Pepper.
It's just so weird you say that because you're always saying like how the story is why you go see movies. I'm not like that, but I love the story in Lincoln. I love history, I guess. Maybe that's why I love the political.
Oh, I love history and politics too. It's just,
I love the political like strategy of that movie. Cause that's really what it's about. You know, I
love the idea of Lincoln. It's just, I don't really care for the execution of it, if that makes any sense.
For me, most of it works. There's only a few moments I would cut out. I mean, it's not like a perfect movie or a great movie, but it's still very good. I mean, I don't know. We'll have to discuss that later.
One day we'll do a Lincoln versus Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. That'll be a great episode.
I'm not watching that. That's
it's so amazing. It's amazing.
Oh,
It's top 10 material. It's amazing.
Top 10 for 2012?
Never mind.
I mean, I'm not trying to be a snob. I mean, I just don't have any interest in watching that. Honestly, it's just not.
It's amazing. You hear it here, folks. I love Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Oh, okay.
but yeah. So, LA Confidential. What else did we like about this movie? Because I just love the story, and I love how really, you know, actually let's talk about how racism is used in this movie.
Yeah.
Everyone loves talking about this.
Well, I mean, it's not so obvious. It's not obvious. It's not like, it's not in your face in terms of like, it's not trying to like,
it's an organic part of the movie.
Yeah, it's just part of the setting. Then it's like, it makes you kind of uncomfortable to see it sometimes. But that's what it is. I mean, it's like that, you know, the scene, first scene where it comes up is when their what's his name? His partner, his like crazy partner, goes down to the people being held in the jail.
Mike, I'm trying to.
Yeah, it's the guy that gets killed. It's the guy that gets murdered. Christmas night, he goes down to the jail and they start beating up the.
Keep talking, I'll look it up.
Yeah, he starts beating up the prisoner, the people in the jail that are Hispanic. And the reason isn't even that clear, if I remember right. He's just drunk one night, basically. And they he's told that they did something. He was told why they're in prison or why they're in jail, and he just goes berserk. And it's almost like it's disturbing to watch everybody else getting in and not
Stenslin.
Yeah, that's his name. It's disturbing to watch everybody else just basically join in, you know, like Guy Pearce is the only one trying to stop them. He gets locked in his own like prison cell.
Yeah.
I love the scene too. The transition. This is where it's all about the filmmaking. I love the transition where the guy takes the photograph and it freezes. There's a freeze frame, and it turns into the newspaper photo that the guy holds up, who's interviewing everybody about the incident. That's just a great transition, I think. And the title of the newspaper
is editing.
Yeah, it's an editing transition. Yeah, it's perfect. And the headline is Bloody Christmas. You know. It's just that's fantastic the way the whole sequence goes down and just the, anyway.
Yeah. I love it because it's an organic part of the setting. And also it comes up later in that, Exley is like, I think escorting like the Latino girl that was in the that was held hostage and raped. Mm-hmm. Like she's, you know, being held out and she's like, yeah, I said all this, you know, because I wanted them captured. I wanted them, you know, in jail. I wanted them, or I wanted them killed. I wanted nothing was probably going to happen if I said, yeah, they were not the guys that killed the other six people in the other thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was just like, It all works because it all is about, you know, creating this atmosphere of doubt and creating this atmosphere of mystery, in that not everything is always as it would seem. Not everything.
Yeah.
It's not everything is just this picture perfect for the papers.
Yeah.
And it's something Exley has to, you know, grow to, you know, do, because sometimes, you know, people lie and they have great reasoning for it. So it all works in the theme, and it all works into the setting, and it all works into the characters of the movie. And ultimately, I mean, it's just the fun and ultimately it all culminates, you know, to a fantastic, you know, ending.
Yeah. It's a great shootout too, which it's funny because like, there's a lot of action scenes in this, but it never feels mindless because
doesn't feel like a Michael Bay.
Well, Michael Bay would never make a movie like this, but what it doesn't feel like is a movie called The Untouchables from 1987, which is a movie I despise for the reasons why I love this movie. Have you seen The Untouchables?
From Brian De Palma?
Yeah. From Brian De Palma. Have you seen that?
No, but that's on the list. Or
it's awful. A lot of people like it. Some people don't like, I think Ebert didn't like it, but anyway, it doesn't matter. I hate that movie because it's just about them going after Al Capone and just leaving a trail of bodies in the process. I guess that's fine to make a movie like that, but it's goofy. It's the action isn't well done. It's the characters are simple. It has nothing else besides just, I don't like Sean Connery in the supporting role that he gave. I know everybody else loves, but there's no depth to any of it. I mean, if it was just filmed so well that, you know, that the action was that good, maybe it would be better. But this has like, it's about something similar, but it's much more intricate in the way it does it. You know, it's about, because in the end, it's funny. In the end, Guy Pearce does kind of break his own rule. Like he's kind of, because the whole, it begins with James Cromwell telling him, sometimes would you shoot a criminal if you knew that he broke the law, you know, and then he was going to get away. And he says, no, I wouldn't. But at the end of it, James Cromwell is about to tell the police that, you know, what he's about to lie to the police when they come, and he shoots him in the back. And so he kind of, it's interesting that the way it begins and ends.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's about cops kind of being Machiavellian, you know, ends justify the means, but it's not just celebrating that. It's kind of saying, okay, it's wrong, but sometimes you have to go that far if you're exposing corruption. But, you know, it's just so well done that way. It's not like,
hey, Brandon, do you know what that's called?
What?
It's my favorite word ever. It's called a character arc.
Ed, yeah, well, Ed actually does have a character arc in some ways, yeah. But like great. I said, Yeah, I know. It's great. Yeah, when there's arcs, but really, he's the only one that has an arc. Not, and that's fine. You know, like Bud White doesn't. Kevin Spacey dies before he gets to have one. Really, Kale. My point about that is that I'm always joking around with character arcs. And how it's not necessary. You know, not every movie needs to have that, right? Like Raiders of the Lost Ark is perfectly fine without having a character arc. I mean, like no one changes in Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's not even remotely. You can't argue that they change. There's other movies like that, but
yeah, that's fair.
Yeah. I mean, I probably actually prefer Raiders of the Lost Ark to this, or maybe I don't, I'm not sure, but you know, it's not like it's great. Yeah. The writing in this is great, but
it's character arcs are a really good way. The reason in my always response to you is character arcs. They're not always necessary, but they are always great ways. It's an easy way to get a movie going.
Yeah, it is.
A great way to build a story.
Yeah, and I don't mind two-dimensional characters sometimes because that's needed. I mean, James Cromwell plays a great villain in this. He's pretty two-dimensional, but he's corrupt. He's a corrupt police officer. That's all you need, you know? It's not.
And it's very, and that's the only thing I would say against the movie is it's really easy to see that he is the villain.
Yeah, but at the same time, the theme of the movie is corruption. I mean, you kind of know that from the get-go. I expected there to, it's okay that we expect him to be the villain.
Yeah, it's fine. It's just, as far as like a massive reveal, it's not like, you know, it's not that big of a shock.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah. Which is fine with me too, because like I said, with the mystery movies, I'm less concerned about the mystery and about other stuff about the movie. Like the only movie that like, where it's just the mystery is so compelling. I mean, there are some movies that are like that. Actually, Prisoners. Yeah, Usual Suspects. And actually, Prisoners is like that. I was mentioning that before we started the podcast. I watched that recently. The mystery in that is so good that that's worth watching just for the mystery. But that's rare, though, for me.
Yeah. So what else do we have to say on LA Confidential? Because I really, you know, I've kind of said my piece. I really enjoy it. One of my top five LA noir stories, and it's one of the best, and it's just, I think it's got a really great story, and I really, as I said, I really love Exley's character arc. Yeah, Bud White doesn't change that much, and I would argue that Jack Vincent changes more in this movie than Bud White, but yeah, I thought all the characters had equal development. And I even liked when Bud White broke, like when he just broke because, you know, his relationship with Kim Basinger characters, you know, basically, you know, been, you know, it's been shattered by Exley, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, I just liked, you know, all these characters and all their moments, and I loved how it all organically fit into the story, and that's really, and honestly, that's all I have to say about this movie.
Well, it's funny because, I mean, this is a movie where I've noticed flaws before, but it's only because I've watched it five times, and when I watch a movie five times, I love it so much that I don't care about the flaws, honestly. You know, right. It's like the scene where Guy Pearce and Kim Basinger kind of hook up. It's like, okay, that's not really plausible because it doesn't seem like his character, but who cares? I mean, that's just kind of the plot kind of doing its job and building conflict. But
it's the weakness of man, Brandon.
I guess maybe. I don't know. But that character's so reserved that he doesn't seem like the kind of guy who would just do that. But yeah, maybe he would. I don't know. Other than that, I don't have much else to say. I mean, it's one of my favorites. So.
Yeah, I think we've covered it here for the 20th anniversary. I almost said 30th. Wouldn't that be something? The 20th anniversary for LA Confidential. Great movie. I don't know if
Before we stop, how does this rank in 1987 for you? Since we were discussing other movies that year in terms of the top five movies of that year.
I would have to go more. It probably is in the top five.
Mm-hmm.
I still really like Titanic.
I do too. Yeah. I know everybody likes to to rant about that movie. I still love it, though.
I mean, Titanic, it is problematic. Like, I will hand people problems that it's Downton Abbey meets an action movie. But yeah, it's, but yeah, I really like Titanic. I haven't seen Good Will Hunting in a while, so I have to rewatch it.
That's great. Yeah.
I guess Boogie Nights would be number one, and then this movie, and then I have to put Men in Black in there. That movie still is
not sure if it's perfect. That good though.
It is pretty damn like well fine tuned.
Really? You think so?
Oh yeah. I mean, it has nothing to say. It has nothing brilliant or amazing to say. It's just, it's kind of like Ghostbusters. It's just an incredibly well-made comedy.
But see, with Ghostbusters and Men in Black and Gremlins and those kind of movies, I don't watch that really that often. Like, I saw Men in Black probably 4 years ago. I don't, it's not a movie I can quote, or like the characters are all that great, or
I should mention
the action isn't all that good. Like, I don't know. It's okay.
I should mention,
I like it, but
I don't watch these movies religiously, like every year or whatnot. It's just, you know, Men in Black is just one of those smart movie that, yeah, it kind of falls apart when the plot has to get going, but the brilliance of Tommy Lee Jones and Will Smith cannot be understated.
Yeah, I mean, my top five for that year, and I'm not sure what order they would be in it, but it's this movie, LA Confidential, Good Will Hunting, Boogie Nights, Titanic, and probably Jackie Brown would be the fifth, my fifth favorite. So yeah, I don't know what order though. I mean, I think probably LA Confidential is my favorite one of this year, or of that year. Maybe Good Will Hunting be number two. I don't know. It's hard to say.
Well, yeah, Brandon, it's kind of hard to talk about movies that came out in a year where we were toddlers. So,
but you know, they haven't aged though. That's what's interesting. I mean, have they really aged? Like,
no,
all four of these movies were, or all five could be released today, and it wouldn't make any difference. I mean, LA Confidential looks like it was made today. I mean, in a lot of ways.
I mean, some, but I don't know. Like, I guess not. I mean, it's, and they haven't aged. I'm just saying, like, it's hard to pick movies that we loved in a year where we were toddlers, so we wouldn't have remembered seeing. We don't have any nostalgia or any.
Well, I have nostalgia for all four of those movies I mentioned, or all five, because I watched them when I was like a teenager. Like, I remember renting LA Confidential from Netflix the first time, not knowing what it was, knowing it was critically acclaimed, but like being completely surprised to me. And the same thing with Boogie Nights, and same thing with Good Will Hunting, you know. So I'm nostalgic for it, just not the year it came out. You know, I'm nostalgic for it because I watched it in 2010 and 2009. As weird as that sounds, but
yeah. So, with that said, Brandon, you don't have any place where the good people can find you, right?
No.
Okay. You can find me on Twitter at Movie Kale. You can also follow this podcast at The Youth Critic, and you can also follow the channel that distributes this podcast at KHG Network. Thanks, everyone. I don't know what the next Youth Critic thing will be. I think we'll come back and do straight, like, review what came out on Christmas Day. Like, hey, Brandon, are you interested at all in seeing All the Money in the World or Darkest Hour?
Yeah, I want to see Darkest Hour. Yeah, All the Money in the World, maybe.
To put you on the spot. It's just I thought.
Yeah, I want to see Darkest Hour, and it may not be as good as I think it'll be, but I can guarantee you though that, like, it's just funny that it came out the same year Dunkirk came out, because that's why I won from Dunkirk. I won that. I won some Churchill movie. Like,
something struck again.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm probably gonna see Darkest Hour. I'm not sure about All the Money in the World, but.
All right. I think we'll come back and we'll review movies like Jumanji and maybe The Greatest Snowman, Showman, excuse me. And
I'm not seeing that one.
And if there's any Pitch Perfect people I can run up and do podcasts with, we'll do a segment where we review Pitch Perfect 3.
So you want to go see, you're planning to go see The Greatest Showman?
Oh yeah. Why?
Have fun with that. I will not be seeing that one.
Bill Condon's co-writing this. This is going to be great.
Bill Condon, who's?
he did Kinsley.
Oh, that's good. Okay. Yeah.
Kinsley, Gods and Monsters, Dreamgirls. He did do the last two Twilight movies, but even those were kind of fun to an extent. So, yeah, I will. Dude,
but isn't it a musical, though? I mean, God, it's like.
Yeah. Well, so is La La Land.
And that's the worst movie of 2016.
God damn it.
I mean, don't just musicals give you like just a creepy like vibe, like a just a uncomfortable no. feeling in the pit of your stomach? Like, it just makes me, ugh. Like,
no, that's just you.
Like, it's just so bizarre. I don't know. I mean, isn't the movie interrupted when I start singing?
I don't know. I haven't seen it yet.
No, I mean, in all musicals, isn't the movie just interrupted? Like, all the character development, all the story stuff, just...
It depends. It depends. Like, it depends on... It depends on how the song is used.
Ugh, I don't know. I mean, I like it. It's fine in cartoons and, like, the Muppets, you know, but it's for kids. But I can't watch adults sing and dance and take it seriously. Just by... on principle, no matter what it is. I just know.
I'm just shaking my head. All right. We have went a little overboard, but thanks everyone for listening, and we'll be back with you next everything. Time.
Why was Susan Leffert at the Night Owl?
I don't know. I never heard of the Night Owl till today.
How about some payback, big time?
We need evidence. I'll get the evidence.
It was an information exchange.
You have any proof?
The proof had his throat slit.
What do you want, actually?
I just want to solve this thing.
Even if it means paying the consequences.